Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of intraretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today in episode 157, Dr. Sriji Patel from Vanderbilt University joins me to preview the March 2019 issue of Retinal Physician. We discuss complement inhibition for age-related macular degeneration, new agents such as faricizumab and brolucizumab, and pre-filled syringes for injectable medications. All articles can be found online at retinalphysician.com. A list of financial disclosures for myself and Dr. Patel are attached to this episode in the episode description. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be rejoined by Dr. Sriji Patel. Dr. Patel is an assistant professor of ophthalmology at Vanderbilt University, and he's here joining me to preview the March issue of Retinal Physician. Sriji, welcome back, and thanks for doing this.
Great. Thanks, Jay, for having me.
So, again, like our other Retinal Physician episodes, this is unlike our journal club. We're just going to use the articles in Retinal Physician as a jumping off point for discussion. These articles are all available online at retinalphysician.com. If you want to actually read the articles, so we're just going to use them to inspire some discussion. So the first article that we're looking at was a peer-reviewed article by Grant Holm and Rishi Singh entitled Complement Inhibitors for Treatment of Geographic Atrophy and Advanced Non-Exudative AMD. Subtitle, Potential Exists to Slow or Prevent Disease Progression. And essentially what they looked at was reasons why the complement system may be a good target in macular degeneration and some of the complement trials that have ongone and medications that have been studied. Most are either in trial or even pre-trial data. Lampalizumab, obviously the most famous, but already went through trial and failed at phase three to show a meaningful improvement for geographic atrophy. Sriji, when you're just thinking about complement, I mean, again, we right now, I think we're in a relatively simple era for treatment of AMD where we have anti-VEGF for wet AMD, and we don't really have great treatments for dry AMD besides, you know, AREDs and smoking and things for prevention. When you have patients or if you had family members who had AMD ask you about the complement and inhibitors and what's going on, what do you kind of tell them or what sort of take do you give?
Sure. You know, I'll have patients that come up to me you know, and they always hear about injections. Injections get a lot of press, and they'll have dry AMD, and I'll tell them, you know, for dry AMD, we really don't have a lot. But I always am quick to add in that there's a lot in the pipeline. It's, you know, I tell patients, you know, a lot of them who are, you know, especially a little younger, that in their lifetime, I really do think that we're going to have good treatments for dry AMD. And one of the pathways that's really being looked at, you know, Grant Holm and Rishi Singh really do a good job of kind of reviewing what's been done and what's kind of on the pipeline is complement inhibition. You know, we know that certain complement genetic variants really do predispose or provide act as risk factors for AMD, and that makes it an interesting area. You know, you touched on this. I think that we all had really high hopes for lampalizumab, you know, especially with the really encouraging phase two data. Phase three really, you know, as we all know now, really didn't bear out like everyone thought they would. But it's still very, you know, it's an exciting area of study. And I think, especially, you know, one of the studies that's mentioned here, Apellis looking at APL2, you know, I think that they also had very encouraging phase two results. And I think, you know, right now, the last I had heard, their study was still on hold. I'm not sure if they'd started up yet or not. But it's an exciting time, and I think it's a target that makes a lot of sense in terms of the inflammatory component of macular degeneration.
You know, I think one of the things people have mentioned before who are basic scientists, you know, Ajay Kurian's example, Dan Chow, I think that even though it makes implicit sense, I think that's it's always kind of this cautious optimism, right, where just because something makes sense from a pathway perspective – doesn't mean that it will bear fruit, although it is exciting. And just because something looks promising, lampalizumab is the classic example, looks really promising phase one, phase two, until it really gets past that final hurdle, it doesn't really necessarily have clinical import, unfortunately, because A, it means the efficacy is not there. B, it means the drug won't be available on the market to patients. And again, these drugs are expensive to develop. If there's a big kind of hard stop, if you don't pass phase three, it's just really difficult to get past that.
Yeah, I think you know, Lambda Wisdom have really provided a lot of teaching lessons for us, because I remember there'd be a time when patients would come to me with that information and they'd be like, you know, when is this drug going to be available? And I'll tell them, oh, you know, it's still kind of going through the important phase three endpoints. And when it failed to meet those, there was, you know, I think a kind of a wave of disappointment across the community, just because, you know, we, other than the vitamins, which, you know, we know help, but it's certainly not the panacea that we're all looking for these, especially these advanced dry AMD patients. We really don't have anything for these patients. And I think that it's fertile ground for clinical trials, but they are expensive and a lot of them really don't really see see the light of day.
Well, moving on from this, and again, if people want to read more about complement, they can read this article. One of the other articles, and this issue kind of focused on different ones, and this was actually, we have to mention, it was a sponsored study. I mean, Novartis is obviously, I'm very excited about brolucizumab, and this was a write-up by Judy Kim, John Prenner, and Ramin Tadayoni looking at two-year brolucizumab data. And again, the big take-home points from the phase three tier two data, less patients had fluid than in the brolucizumab group versus the aflibercept group. Reductions were approaching statistical significance in HAQ. They were statistically significant in HARRIER when comparing those two groups. And the biggest thing was that they were more able to maintain on a 12-week dosing, though, again, it was very, very high. 12-week dosing interval in year two, 82% in HAQ, 75% in HARRIER. And again, there's other take-home points you can read. And this goes through to kind of their implications of the study. I mean, we've talked a little about brolucizumab in the future. We'll see when it actually gets FDA approval. And we've talked a little bit about how people may incorporate it. What are your thoughts? I mean, what are you going to do when the drug hits market? Is this something that you're going to use as primary therapy? What patients would you consider using this in? And again, full disclosure, I don't think either of us is a consultant for Novartis, though I am a consultant for Alcon, which is a subdivision for Novartis.
Yeah, I'm not a consultant for Novartis. I'm a primary investigator for their ongoing DME trial, Kestrel, but I'm not, I don't receive any funds from Novartis. I'm excited. You know, I think, John Prenner kind of talked about this. I'm excited to see what it does in the clinic. One of the things we know is even with the really good anti-VEGF treatments that we have right now, there's still, you know, anywhere from 25 to 40% of our patients that really just don't respond well. And I'm interested to see, you know, the big push behind brolucizumab is it's a single chain antibody fragment. So it's smaller, and in being smaller, they can achieve much higher molar concentration of drug. You know, I think it's 11 to 13 times higher molar concentration of VEGF suppressing power versus aflibercept. And we can see that in the results. You know, the drying power over aflibercept, which is already very good at drying the macula, was even stronger, and patients were able to maintain out to 12 weeks. And so it's exciting. Some of, you know, to answer your question, some of it's really going to come down to, in my mind, cost. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to see how much this medication ends up being. You know, already, you know, I think everyone is aware of just how much of a burden, you know, the anti-VEGF treatments are kind of on the healthcare system. And enough people are paying attention to it now where, you know, companies are, or insurance companies and carriers are kind of dictating what we can do. And brolucizumab may be one of those last line treatments because of it. You know, unless the people that dictate this feel that there really is ability to push these patients out to 12 weeks consistently, and that's going to decrease overall treatment burden, I still think that we're going to have to probably start with bevacizumab and kind of work our way up.
Your point on cost is just right on. I think that's such a dictator, right? So, and I agree. I have no idea how this is going to be priced. I really have no insight. And I don't even know from a marketing perspective where they would price it. Depends how they feel about the drug in the market. But for example, if it ends up being cheaper than either aflibercept or ranibizumab, then once we start using it and get comfortable with it, then it becomes more of an argument to use it as second line maybe. For us, sure, to use bevacizumab first line. I know some people start with on-label first line, but if you're using even off-label first line, it becomes a strong argument. The real question comes, if it does offer that greater durability, do you go up the ladder? And at what cost point does it become prohibitive to go up the ladder? I think we've seen a different sort of example because the side effect profile is different, but With DME, for example, we have the three anti-VEGF agents, but we also have steroids that vary in cost. And the on-label steroid dexamethasone implant is significantly more expensive, for example, than off-label steroid. But you have fluocinolone, which is very, very expensive up front, but because of the durability, it may make sense for some patients. It's just an interesting, we won't know until we see how it behaves, right? So, but those are all going to be considerations, the cost relative to the benefits. And then, again, some of it's just how comfortable we get using it. And I think it's always interesting to see how things get introduced to the market in terms of practice. I remember we were in residency, I believe, when aflibercept came out. At least here, it was a slow adoption. It wasn't super rapid. It took some time for it to kind of gain people to gain confidence in it and people to start using it more consistently. I remember when I started, at least as a resident, we were using it very infrequently for the first year or two.
Yeah, and I honestly think brolucizumab is going to be similar, again, because I feel people have their algorithms, you know. Both, you know, aflibercept has been around for years now. It's been a long time since we've had a new anti-VEGF agent come on out. And so people have their algorithms. And I think that what's going to end up happening is they might pull this out of the cabinet when they have these really resistant cases or patients that they really can't extend out past 4 or 6 weeks, and then slowly start adopting it more and more, similar to what we did with aflibercept. You know, when we initially, I remember we would just use it for those last line patients that really were struggling on the current agents. And I think that as we get more and more comfortable with brolucizumab, then we'll start using it more and more. I would be surprised if I started using it first line for AMD, just because I feel like I've had really good results with bevacizumab. But maybe it'll kind of be on the shelf there next to aflibercept.
Exactly. Well, two more articles we're going to quickly just run through. The second to last, the mechanism of bispecific antibody faricizumab. Subtitle, targeting VEGF-A and Ang-2 has effect greater than targeting either alone, by Nazlul Ramajadmir and Arshad Khanani. Again, just talking about another drug, faricizumab, which used to be known as RG7716 from Genentech. Again, neither of us has disclosures for this one. It's a first-in-class bispecific antibody. Again, it has the VEGF-A as well as the Ang-2 blockade. And again, it's in trial. There was the phase 2 trial, which was Boulevard. You also have Avenue and Stairway, which looked more at the durability, and AMD. Boulevard was for DME, and comparing it to ranibizumab. And it seems to show enough promise where we're looking towards phase 3 trials for neovascular AMD. And already Yosemite and Rhine are ongoing looking for DME. We're still waiting for the name for our neovascular AMD study. Again, another option, not complement, but looking different. This is something that may be useful for multiple diseases, not just for AMD. Similar sort of discussion, right, Sriji, in terms of benefits, but I guess it just, again, speaks to, we're going to have a lot more complicated decision-making on our hands in the next couple of years when we see a patient with DME or AMD.
Yeah, you know, and you know, you and I have talked about this before. It's one of those things where it's really going to have to end up individualizing. You know, we're going to have lots of individualized treatment regimens. Right now, I feel like you can kind of use the same one or two algorithms for most of your patients. But as we get more and more agents, and we realize that I think we realize now AMD is more of a heterogeneous disease than we initially thought. You know, there's a lot of different phenotypes too, just exudative AMD. We're going to start having other options. One of the things, you know, this is the first medication that's really gained a lot of traction in the highly touted kind of suppression of the Ang-2 pathway. And so I'm excited. I'm excited to see phase 3 results again. You know, we always want to temper our expectations when we see exciting phase 2 results. But, you know, I'm excited to see what this medication can do comparing itself to the current standards of care.
I think the other interesting thing, we don't really think about this because we're both in academic institutions, but from a practice standpoint, I wonder, you know, practices utilize economies of scale, but also storage of these medications. I know we're not the first physician subspecialty to worry about storage of medications, but the question is, as a practice, how many of these medications are going to keep on hand? Again, cost is going to play a role, but to keep them stored and separated, and it really will be interesting to see if you have 7 or 8 or 9 different options, are you going to keep them all on hand? Our practice is going to kind of, again, providers I'm sure will have their preferences, but if you're really talking about optimizing individualized therapy, these aren't medications you walk into a CVS and you just say, hey, I'd like some Avastin, and they give to you.
Sure,
you know,
yeah.
So you rely on your doctor and your physician to kind of store these medications. That's the other side of it. I'm curious. We probably won't worry about it now or in the next couple of years, but 5-10 years, it'll be an interesting discussion.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, the cost alone of storing these types of medications, you know, there's a lot of necessary infrastructure required. And as we get more and more options, you're right, it's going to become really complex. And it's an important consideration because, especially, you know, I think most of us go to satellite clinics and trying to maintain the options that we need at the satellite clinic while also being logistically feasible, it's going to definitely play a role. So yeah, I think that's a great point, you know, obviously with the cost, but also with the cost of keeping all these different types of medications, balancing that with giving all our patients all the possible options.
You know, the last thing is discussing prefilled syringes for intravitreal anti-VEGF medications by Michael Colicello. Prefilled syringes, obviously, this is coming to light with ranibizumab. The big thing, I think, is the benefits were kind of outlined here. I think the biggest thing we both agree is you eliminate one step for drawing up medication, which is a risk factor for potential infection and contamination. Dose or accuracy, those are also very good benefits. You know, again, I've only used the prefilled syringes for ranibizumab. I believe that bevacizumab is also available in prefilled syringes, depending on where you get a compound. Usually we get it in prefilled syringes, but doesn't come, you know, at the dose. It usually comes with some overfill that you push out. And I think the ranibizumab comes with a little bit as well. It makes sense to me, Shriji. I feel like if you're designing drugs in the future, you should have them as prefilled syringes. There may be extra cost to that, but from an infection standpoint, there is some data out there saying that the prefilled syringes may reduce the risk of endophthalmitis.
Yeah, you know, I thought they did a kind of a great job discussing the benefits of prefilled syringe. And the big benefit that I see is really that one less step in terms of drawing up the medication. You know, one of my idiosyncrasies is I still draw up all, you know, we get bevacizumab in prefilled syringes. I use aflibercept, you know, maybe, you know, 10 to 20% of the time, but I still draw up my own aflibercept because I'm just so hyper aware of the potential for introducing infection in that step. And so, you know, I'll use ranibizumab here and there, and I really do appreciate the prefilled syringe. I just feel like it's one less concern in the process, in the chain. And so I think that, you know, I wonder, faricizumab, if that starts seeing the light of day, or brolucizumab, are they just going to go straight to the prefilled syringes, especially when, you know, they conducted a large study and showed that, you know, you really are able to affect the number of patients that you would expect with endophthalmitis if you kind of decrease this one step in the process. So I actually don't see any downfall other than presumably it's a little bit more costlier for the companies.
Well, Shriji Patel, thanks so much for joining me. Again, the article is available online at retinalphysician.com. If you want to check out what we discussed, we'll have a journal club up later this week where we'll go more in depth on peer-reviewed articles. Shriji, thank you for doing this and hope to have you back soon.
Great, Jay. Thanks so much. Take care.
Take care. As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 157 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. We have our blog on the website, and we have a relatively new feature over the last couple of months where two of our students, Mike Benincasa and Amy Klustervoor, they reflect on the latest episode and offer their perspective. Those make for great reads on the go. On the website, you can also sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the Apple Podcast Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the Apple Podcast Store, Android Store. We are on Twitter at Retina Podcast. To contact us, click on the contact us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We love getting feedback on things we can do better and things we're already doing well. We also love episode ideas. I've gotten a couple of great ones recently we hope to implement in the next few months. And we also appreciate everyone who has subscribed via the Apple Store or Android Store who's left your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. Shriji Patel for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Benincasa, and Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Finally, thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. This is Jay Schreather, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cut.